This is Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with Alan Weider. Alan is a retired professor at the University of South Carolina, historian, oral historian, who has written books, a number of books. One of them is Ruth First and Joe Slovo in the War Against Apartheid. When I first got the notice we were going to talk to him, I thought it was about that. And I said, oh, yeah, I've always wanted to talk about Joe Slovo. But no, we're talking about somebody else who I care deeply about, who's been on our show six or seven times before he passed away, who is the only radio hero that I have, Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, and Mostly Conversation. And Alan Weider, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thanks, Mark. I'm thrilled to be here.
And we'll tell you more about this, but on Thursday night at 7:30.
7:30.
Studs. Alan Weider. <Wow. laughs> We'll be bringing Studs Terkel to life at Red Emma's. Something you won't miss. We'll tell you more about that in the conversation. So, I don't want to assume that many of our newer listeners who have not listened for the entire 24 years we've been on the air, but and will not remember our talks with Studs, will remember who Studs is in this area. So, let's start at the beginning. Why you wrote this book about Studs? And who was Studs to you and to us?
Okay. And let me say, because it's interesting, you know, Studs Terkel and Joe Slovo both wore Red Sox, and it was definitely a political statement for both. And I have to say, I think they would have absolutely loved knowing each other. But that's another story, right? So Mark, you said I was an oral historian, and I worked on my graduate degree in the late 70s, and oral history was not valued in academia at that time. I don't know that it is still, but I was fortunate enough to have a committee who loves Studs' work. And I saw myself as having a lifelong debt to Studs Terkel, because I think I was able to do the work I did in academia for many, many years, to do oral histories as a university professor, because of Studs' work. Studs kind of gave validity. That's not the word that he would use or that I should have, but he made it okay in academia. So that's how I came to it. I thought I never knew I would do a book, but then in the 1990s, just before I got involved in writing about people who fought apartheid in South Africa, I sort of started to formulate a book in my head. A friend of mine, a very close friend who I dedicate the book to, Craig Rydell, mentioned that, you know, it seems like you're writing the book without using the computer right now. So when I finished the book on Ruth and Joe, it was time to do a book on Studs. And Studs Terkel, you know, there's always the why question. There's the personal why question, which is I really still feel that Studs was important to me being able to do my work. But there's the broader why question of why Studs Terkel? What does Studs Terkel mean? And he was about so many things. You mentioned that you've done the show for 24 years. Studs had the same radio show for 45 years. So he was born in 1912. He actually went to law school at the University of Chicago, graduated from law school, passed the bar, and never practiced for a day in his life. He didn't see himself as a lawyer. His line was, I went to law school hoping that law was Clarence Darrow, and it turned out to be Julius Hoffman, the judge at the Chicago 7 trial. and he had lines like that. He said, can you imagine being in a law school class where fellow students were Bernadine Dorn and John Ashcroft. So he had this wit about him in terms of kind of making fun of himself and also of political situations, but he was so much more than that. And so he became involved as an actor, and he was a lifelong ham. He acted throughout his life, and he was involved in the Chicago Repertory Theater in Chicago in the 30s, and that was a group that not only played in theater venues, but played in bar halls and union halls, played on the streets, and they were very political in their work in theater. And then he he participated in one of FDR's plans. He was part of the Illinois Writers Project, and that's where he met Nelson Algren and they were lifelong friends, and he met him at the John Reed House. So there's all this political weaving that started when he was a teenager. He used to listen with his father when Eugene Debs made speeches as the socialist candidate for president in the United States, and went on to be a lifelong third-party guy. He always supported third-party candidates. But in the late 40s and then early 50s, he was blacklisted. He moved from radio, where he always referred to himself as a disc jockey. He actually acted in radio sitcoms, but he always played the gangster that got killed. He said, "I never lived. I never could come on for sequences because they'd kill me off." But he was blacklisted, and he was blacklisted because he was involved in many different political organizations. One of Studs' lines was, "I never met a petition I didn't sign." But he had this wonderful TV show that took place in a diner. It was called Studs Place, and he created it, and he was Studs in the diner. It was like some people compared it to Cheers later on.
Uh-huh.
It was much more gritty. But the waitress, who was a good friend of his and a singer, she wore a union button in every show. And there were two other Chicago shows, Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, and Dave Garraway had a show, and all three were ready to move to New York and go national. And they asked Studs Terkel to sign a loyalty oath, and he wouldn't do it. And his show was canceled, and the other two moved to New York. And he was blacklisted, and it was a tough time. His wife, Ida, and we can talk about Ida because she was an incredible political figure in Chicago, was a social worker, and so she supported the family. And then in 1952, he was listening, I think it was Christmas Eve, it might have been New Year's Eve, to this radio station, WFMT, and he heard them playing Woody Guthrie, and he thought, "I'm the only person on radio that ever played Woody Guthrie." And so he called them up. And the line, some of these lines are apocryphal, but they're wonderful. Studs had this thing that truth is more important than fact. And so he was a great storyteller. But anyway, they said, "Yes, we know who you are. We'd love for you to be part of our station, but we have no money." And he said, "Well, then we're even. I have no money either. When can I start?" And 45 years later was his last show. But so he was he had a radio show. He interviewed such a breadth of people. I mean, you know that as yourself as a radio host, from opera to Stokely Carmichael to movie people who he didn't particularly like to have on, to some political people, to authors over and over again. And he got this reputation as an interviewer, as being a man who believed in conversation, and people were amazed when they went on his show. There's many, many people told me the same story of going to his show, and every page of the book had yellow marker covering things.
Right.
And Victor Navasky, who was longtime editor of The Nation, tells a great story of going for the first time on Studs' show. I forget what book, it might have been for his book on the blacklist, actually. And Studs said, and I can't do his voice, but that doesn't mean I don't try, because people always try to do his voice. And Studs going, "Let's turn to page 63. Here's what you said. Do you know how significant that is? Nobody's ever said that." And Victor Navasky's like, "Wow, I didn't know I made such an – that was so insightful."
Well, I mean –
that kind of thing.
I mean, for Studs, I mean, there's so much to say here. I mean, I think – just purely in terms of radio, before I go back in time a bit, I mean, Studs, as you talk about in here, in your book, he said, and he was right, and I think it's one of the first lessons I learned a long time ago, and Studs and I talked about this, which was being a radio host, being an interviewer, there's only one quality you need. Listen, listen, listen. And that's the quote you give him in the book when he says that. And I think that's what he was so brilliant. He respected. I mean, you have this part in your book where you talk about how Studs Terkel talks about the craft of radio, and said, you know, a carpenter or plumber wouldn't arrive without his tools in his box. And, you know, if you're going to be a host and interview people, you have to know who you're going to interview. You have to read their book. You have to think about who they are. You have to like and respect them, or why do it? And that, you know, that was his whole way he approached radio. And you really captured that in this book, I think. That part is studs.
Thanks. Thank you. I mean, I think, you know, you got the perfect quote about the carpenter. And the only thing I have to add on to that is that Studs was astounded when interviewers didn't do that. He had one interview. It was in New York, and the guy started the interview with, well, I haven't read your book yet. And Studs was pretty kind to him, which surprised me
right.
when I listened to the interview, you know, that, cause Studs could be tough. And I was a little surprised that he didn't say, well, then why are you interviewing me? You know, that kind of thing.
You know, and take it back to the beginning. I mean, Studs was, I love in your book the way you describe him politically, and because I think it's really, really important to get right about how he really viewed our world and the world around him. I mean, let me just read this one little piece you have in here. When I think of this fellow, what's his name? Haskell Wexler, the filmmaker.
The filmmaker. Yeah.
And Studs says to him, he's talking about these in 1933, these planes that Mussolini had given Chicago in 1933 when Studs was up about 21 or something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I just got done passing Balbo Drive a million times in Chicago.
So he writes, the goddamn fascist, I remember him saying, well, Studs, those are great planes. Looked around the lake. So I said, what's a fascist? Or he says, well, look, kid, fascist is when government and the military and big business, they all get together and they get some joker like Mussolini to confuse the people full of BS and they run the country. That's what a fascist is.
It's so good. It's so good. And, you know, and he lived that. The day he died.
Right.
A year before he died, he was the named person on a suit, Terkel versus AT&T. It was a collective suit about wiretapping and spying on us. And Studs was one of the people. So, I mean, he lived it forever.
He did. I mean, his whole life. One of the things you retouch on in this book, which I think is so, so vitally important when you think about Studs Terkel and the work he did, and we'll talk a minute about the books that he wrote, was that you really focus a significant portion of your writing on Studs and race. And I think that's so important because people forget that. I mean, not just because he wrote Division Street in the book he wrote about race, because he did and he really cared about it deeply, but because it was a huge part of his life. And I think that's something that we cannot forget and we have to really explore is how this man of that generation – because all people who were on the left at that time weren't necessarily didn't deeply understand the nature and depth of racism in America. Studs did.
Yeah, from a very early age. If we talk about race, which I actually think is one of three things that this book that I've written does that hasn't really been done before about Studs, and it started at a very young age, and it started with music. Interestingly, you know, when he went to law school, he did a list of the things that were important to him, and I think law school was fourth or fifth. But first was when he took the bus or the trolley at the time to go to the South Side, he would stop at record stores in what was then called Bronzeville, an African-American neighborhood on the South Side, still the South Side and the North Side, this great, you know, the Great Divide in Chicago. And I think important his commitment against white supremacy in the United States forever is certainly important to Baltimore in terms of history right now and everywhere else in the United States. But he came through it over many, many things. So he became very close to a blues guy, Big Bill Brunzi, and learned so much. He referred to Bill Brunzi and to Mahalia Jackson as two of his teachers in life. And in both cases, there were specific incidents, and I can talk about them, that Studs had to reflect on what he viewed as his own racism. And for someone who fought his whole life against racism, I think it was really powerful that he saw it in himself and knew that it wasn't a good thing. The other side of that, of course, was, you mentioned already, Mark, that his first book was Division Through America, and that was a book about Chicago, actually.
Right.
But Studs Terkel refused to live his life as if Chicago was a divided city between black and white. And again, before he was known for his books, before he was known for his radio station, he was involved in that. As a third-party political supporter his entire life, he worked very hard on Henry Wallace's campaign in 1948 for the presidency. And, you know, Wallace had been Roosevelt's vice president, but he was dumped by the Democrats because they thought Truman was less radical. And the person that Studs did a lot of work with and became friends with was Paul Robeson. And then, after being blacklisted and getting his own radio show, one of the first people he had on was Paul Robeson. Well, that was a courageous act. Robeson was, persona non grata in 1954. So Studs did that. And then, you can point to many things. He, in 1963 alone, I always like to say that Studs fought actively against white supremacy, but he also documented it, which is so important to live on historically. And he documented in both his radio shows and his books. So in 1963, he was in South Africa, and he did an amazing job and put it on his radio show first of interviewing black leaders, black workers, whites who loved apartheid, whites who knew they were privileged and got a lot out of apartheid but knew it was wrong. And he even interviewed Albert Luthuli, the head of the African National Congress. I mean, it was an amazing thing. And he got to him. This is very important for me, probably not for anybody else. But his guide in South Africa was later the Nobel Prize for Literature winner, Nadine Gordimer. And it's in the book, but it's almost like a clandestine story, of how she arranged for Studs to get to meet Albert Luthuli, who was under house arrest, even though he had just won a Nobel Peace Prize. And Nadine, of course, Nadine graciously, at 90 years old before she died, wrote the foreword to my book, Ruth Burst and Joe Slovo and the War Against Apartheid. So there's this bond that is just incredible. And so Studs did that, and then he documented the March on Washington during the same year. So it was quite amazing for me to be able to have that connection. And then in 65, he did the same thing in Montgomery at the end of the Selma Montgomery March. And there was bravery in this, too. In Montgomery, the police came to him because he was interviewing people, and they didn't like that he was interviewing people about the march, interviewing local white people about the march. He said it was he said there were times when he was actually had fear in South Africa, and the only time he ever felt that same fear was in Montgomery, Alabama, as he interviewed white people about civil rights. So you get chills almost thinking about that. We can talk about it more. But then one last thing about race was how much he was respected. So Studs Terkel is the only white person in the Hall of Fame for writers of African descent.
That's right.
And I did an event the other night at Hull House in Chicago, which was one of the places Studs worked very hard to save from the gentrification and the building of the University of Illinois in Chicago. And it was amazing because I was privileged to have Haki Madhubuti, who's a black nationalist in Chicago, a poet, a wonderful poet, gave me a poem to use as the afterword. And he spoke at this launch, and he spoke about Studs and race. And when he referred to Studs, he said Studs was genetically not black, but psychologically and philosophically was a black man in America. So I thought that's the perfect kind of ending to talk about Studs' work in that way.
No, I that's why I'm glad you emphasized that in such a deep way, because you had also Studs, somebody who you had that great quote in here where Studs was on that panel on the Nation cruise going, "What have I done?" But with Nader, but because he always voted for third party people and worked for third party people, this is Nader in 2000. But then in 2008, was really excited about Barack Obama becoming president because a black man was going to be president of the United States.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting story because when President Obama ran for the Senate, Studs was excited in a very substantive way. He thought he was an intellectual, and he even did this line, "Does America deserve an intellectual in the Senate?" You know, and he was excited about him. And then, like you said, by that he thought it was important. Studs died 4 days before Barack Obama was elected.
Right.
In 2008, and he thought that Barack was too ambitious and too moderate for Studs. Studs Terkel was never an ideologue, and so he said,
right,
you know, it's very important that we have a black president, so this is wonderful. But if you had, I've said this before, but if you had to label Studs Terkel, the word would probably, if he had an ism, it was probably underdogism,
right?
And
right,
and
as you wrote, right?
Yeah, not just race, the working people. He was so pro labor, and he was so upset when he thought that labor had been co-opted. And he was truly a man. I used to refer to it as soft socialism. You know, he was truly a man. I mean, one of the questions that I got from people over and over again, and in the last week as I've been traveling, get it constantly, is, was Studs a member? Was Studs CP? Was he in the Communist
right,
Party?
Right.
And the truth is, I have no idea. But it doesn't matter, because even if he was, I can be quite sure he wouldn't have gone to meetings, and he would have hated the rigidity, but he would have loved the cause, and that was Studs.
Well, I mean, as you pointed out, that. For Studs, if he was going to be a communist or a member of the Communist Party, it was the American formation of that in the 30s called the Popular Front that spoke to him
exactly
about America, that was open,
exactly,
you know, not rigid.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what Studs and so many of his comrades, I use that word, it's not used here very often, but it's interesting to me, Mike Frisch, who's a political guy and an oral historian, lives in Buffalo and has done a lot on labor. We talked about this thing because he was friends with people who had also been blacklisted in Buffalo and in other places. And he said there was something, even though Studs has a long history before being blacklisted, there was something about coming out of being blacklisted that gave people this drive that we've got to change the world. And that's our work. They might have had many other things going, as Studs did, but they were so committed to a better life for people who didn't have a good life. And he mentioned this guy, Milt Rogovin, who was an optometrist who became a photographer, and he only photographed working people, perfect for Studs, too. But that there was this drive that we live for a reason. And I think Studs had that. I mean, he had the same worries as, like, he used to refer to people as ordinary but extraordinary, you know? And you could define him both ways, too. So, for example, you know, he wrote 18 books after he was 50. I think the first one came out when he was 57 years old. And he was sort of amazed by his own celebrity. And he used to make fun of being a celebrity. How can you be a celebrity when you write about the uncelebrated? But he'd make fun of it. But he also liked it because he was a human being. And he used it very well to talk about issues of labor. Till the end, if somebody called him, he'd be out emceeing a labor rally.
Thing about Studs, and I think about, he never stopped working, as you said. He
yes,
always was on the move. At 96, he died. He was still writing the night before he died.
Yeah.
He was writing the introduction to his book.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was writing and people, you know, people were continually asking him to write. He had this great line too. People would go, I think he started doing this when he was probably 90. People would go, so can you do this? He was trying to get out of things by then, and he would say, well, I have a deadline. And Bill Ayers tells this story way better than me, but because there was a particular event, and he goes, I have a deadline. And Bill said, well, Studs, what's your deadline? And he said, my deadline is me.
Right.
Which I thought was great. And an extension of that is to really think about, because Studs loved to be amazed by people. He loved to be surprised. And connected to that was that he surprised people about themselves. But here's a man who, after 90 years old, writes a book about death. He called it his death book, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And then follows it with a book on hope. Who does that?
Right, you know? I mean, right, so, right.
Yeah, and both of them are terrific books that he wrote in his 90s.
So you know, Studs, I think it's important that you've written this book, I think, for a lot of reasons, and partially because I think this legacy is so important in terms of what he brought to his work, in terms of his never stopping his belief and battle for freedom on what is right, as you put it in your book, Underdogism. And that what he stood by, I remember. Let me just close with this and get your final thoughts. And so we've whet people's appetite to join you here at Red Emma's. Is that one of the things? The first time I ran through Studs was because there was a woman I worked with back in the '60s. Her name was Peggy Terry. With you join in the Young Patriots. And she told me about this guy, Studs. And she made a joke about it to me because he's, you know, she says to him, well, he's another Jewish guy just like you, but different than other people. So
I love it. Yeah.
And she loved Studs and he loved her. And it was like how he brought her and all these other people out, regular working people who were struggling to make their communities better, struggling to make life a better place, struggling for the rights of other people. That's who he exposed the world to.
Absolutely.
And four, right?
And he loved transformation stories. And Peggy was a transformation story because she had grown up in the South, and it's her also coming to terms with what racism meant in her family and in herself as a child. It's absolutely great in that way. One of my hopes with this, and it's a really hard one, you mentioned it earlier, is that some young people. Get to know Studs. I had young people out in Chicago, 30 students from DePaul at one of the talks, and they only knew Studs because they were in a course on Chicago literature and they'd been reading Studs for 2 weeks, and they were wonderful and their questions were absolutely wonderful. And then at 57th Street Bookstore, I did a conversation there, and two students asked questions, and their questions were great, but they were two young people. I think it's important to know that the foreword to this book was written by a 30-something Jewish hip hop poet by the name of Kevin Koval, and he runs great, and he loves Studs, and he wrote about Studs in his book Shticked, and a book of poetry hopefully the people he leads this organization in Chicago that does slam poetry in the schools, and hopefully through Kevin, because he certainly is pushing the book, that different generations get connected to it, because I think that you and I, Studs is so important to us, and he had so much to say to young people every day, and this is probably a good way to think about it as I end talking about Studs is every day I wake up in terms of Black Lives Matter and racism in America, but also about the current election. and wish that I was listening to Studs at 10 in the morning commenting about it, because it would make it a richer, richer conversation.
Well, I'm really happy you wrote this book, and I want to encourage everyone Thursday to come out and meet Alan at 7:30 at Red Emma's. Have a conversation with him, grab a cup of coffee or a beer, a glass of wine, get something to eat, sit down, and have this conversation with Alan Weeder about his book, Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, and Mostly mostly conversation. Check out Alan Weeder, Studs Terkel, this at Red Emma's Thursday night. And Alan, thank you so much for this book and for bringing all this to our attention. And I look forward to coming to Baltimore.
Thanks, Mark.
We have to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll listen back to the last interview I did with Studs Terkel.